Welcome to this session on Science's Understanding Creation. As you probably heard this morning, we're moving Adam Wright up to the front, and then Roger Stork will follow him. So without any further ado, 20 minutes to speak, five or so minutes of discussion. Adam Wright will be speaking on Explore Material Creation on Its Terms and the Creator on His Terms. The confusion between behind Sean Carroll's scientific investigation of God's existence.
All right, thanks everybody for coming to my talk. So I got bumped up in the schedule, and there was also a misprint somewhere on the room. So I thought I'd make this maximally confusing and change my title as well. So thank you, Cy, for giving the original title. I'm between jobs right now.
It's a little hard to hear you, and I think the recording.
If I stand closer to the recording, is this better?
Yeah.
You know what, if I put this right here, then I won't be tempted to move too far that way. So I'm currently between jobs here. That's why my name tag has been confusing people. So a week ago today, I actually defended my thesis. So I've been in the physics department at Stanford University, and I do galaxy cluster cosmology. So I'm an observational cosmologist. And now I'll be moving to Milwaukee School of Engineering from the Tropical Paradise, which who would want to live there anymore, to this, where I'll be teaching in addition to doing research. So it's a bit about me. I'll be telling you a little bit about Sean Carroll and his book, The Big Picture, today, and then we'll talk about poetic naturalism, which is his philosophy, essentially, his kind of worldview that's laid out in this book, The Big Picture. I'll tell you a bit about his ontology, or his ideas about what exists, and a bit about his epistemology, or how do you know things. And then what I really would like to focus on, and hopefully I'll have enough time to get there, is his abducting God argument. So he has this provocative claim: science has provisionally concluded that naturalism is the best picture of the world we have available. So that's kind of where we're headed. And then I'll talk a bit about seeking nature on nature's terms and what it would look like to seek God on his terms. So a bit about Sean Carroll. He's an atheist physics professor, an author, who does theoretical, like, early universe cosmology stuff. I first got interested in Sean Carroll from his essay, Why Almost All Cosmologists Are Atheists, and I was just very thankful that there was this almost all thing there. He's got a lot of substantive things to say, a lot more than some of the other people in my field, like Stephen Hawking and Lawrence Krauss. So his books are worth reading. So we're going to be focusing on one particular book today. So The Big Picture is a very thick, fat book. It's like 50 chapters long or something, and it's kind of his whole his philosophy on everything. So when he's talking about the big picture, he means something all-encompassing, that he's going to talk about the origins of life, meaning in the universe itself. So he's talking about a lot of things that are beyond what we typically think of as the physical world. So fundamental issues, meta-ethics, meaning of life, stuff like that. But he's a physicalist. So that means that he denies that there's that anything exists beyond the physical or material world. So his philosophical scheme that accounts for this is called poetic naturalism. So poetic naturalism is a specific kind of flavor of naturalism. Sean Carroll's talked about this in a lot of different contexts. So the naturalism part is not that unique. It's something goes something like this. Nature is all that exists. Nature behaves according to natural laws, and then science is our means of learning about the natural world. And I just bolded there science. By science, he means essentially just coming up with models for how the phenomena that underlies what we observe behaves, and then just testing those models against empirical evidence. So it's a fairly broad understanding of science. There's no restriction to testable phenomena, or that it's done within the scientific community or anything like that. It's just coming up with ideas, testing them against objective data. So poetic naturalism is kind of what he's going for is something like naturalism light. He's got a pole to avoid. The pole to avoid for him is eliminativism, or like a strong reductionism, where essentially what eliminativism means is that because you believe that everything's made up of particles, you kind of say, well, then everything above the particle level is not really real. He wants to say no, that there's these other things that emerge from the particle level that are also real. So the key kind of three words that will probably come up again and again here are ways of talking. The way that he's going to account for these emergent phenomena is encapsulated in these three poetic rules here. One, there are many ways of talking about the world. Two, all good ways of talking about the world must be consistent with one another and with the world, must be accurate. And three, our purposes in the moment determine the best way of talking. And if that sounds to you like how could that possibly, those possibly be useful, an example will help. So his kind of paradigmatic example is talking about fluids, or like fluid dynamics, and how you can zoom really, you can zoom in really close on a fluid, and what you'll see is something like particles. A fluid system is just, you know, there's n number of particles, they have n positions and n momenta, and that completely describes the system at the zoomed in level. But you can also kind of take a smoothed overview of this. You can step back, zoom out, and you can treat the same system in a very different way, using a different way of talking, using the language of fluid dynamics. You can talk about then pressure and temperature and viscosity and things like that, these concepts that have absolutely no meaning down at the particle level. So the idea with poetic naturalism is that these are both different ways of talking about the same underlying phenomena, that both of them are valid as long as they give you accurate predictions about the world. They're both valid, and they also have to be consistent with one another, which in fact they are. And then the third poetic rule, the one that says our purposes in the moment determine the best way of talking, just means if we're in a fluid dynamics lab, don't tell me about the positions and momenta of n particles. That's not the most helpful way of talking for our purposes in the moment. It seldom is, unless you're doing like a low temperature physics experiment. It's much more helpful to talk about pressure and temperature and viscosity than it is to talk about these detailed properties here. So the entire idea here is just that from this lower level particle picture, there is emergent phenomena, and he wants to say that that is real as well. So this is an example from a scientific model, but he definitely does not want to limit it to that. So here I have some quotes. Many concepts that are part of non-fundamental ways we have of talking about the world, you know, useful ideas that describe a higher level macroscopic reality deserve to be called real. So He thinks that the emergent phenomena are just as real as the underlying reality from which they emerge, to a certain extent. So here's another kind of key thing, is that this goes beyond scientific models. He says, there is only one world, there are many ways of talking about it, and refer to these ways as models or theories or vocabularies or stories really doesn't matter. So an example he gives is that the rules of basketball are real. They're an accurate way of describing the phenomena that you observe on a basketball court. Here's a nice example of how this, why this has legs in terms of like trying to go beyond eliminativism. So let's talk about the example of, say, human desires. So you might think, if human beings are made up of particles and particles don't have desires, then, you know, human beings can't have desires. So Carroll would call that basically a category mistake within his framework of poetic naturalism. So at the level of description where it's appropriate to talk about you, he says it's also perfectly appropriate to talk about wants and feelings and desires. Those are real phenomena in the best understanding of human beings. You can think of yourself as an individual human being, or you can think of yourself as a collection of atoms, just not both at the same time, at least when it comes to asking how one kind of thing interacts with another. And so that red part there, that comes from that third poetic rule. Our purposes in the moment determine the best way of talking. It's helpful to talk about desires when we're talking about the level at the human level. It's just not helpful if you try to ask that question about the underlying atoms that make up the system. Okay. So, sorry, I didn't explain from the outset. So most of my slides are going to be black. So sometimes it's confusing when somebody is presenting somebody else's ideas, especially if they don't like them, to distinguish to distinguish the person's ideas from like what your critique of the ideas are. I made all of the slides where I'm talking about what Sean Carroll believes in black, and I will have just a few blue slides where, when the blue slide is up, what I'm saying is my own opinion.
That's a good
last one. Yes. Yeah. So I'll be waiting for the blue slides as I'm explaining the black ones. So hopefully this will be clear. We'll see, I guess. So some potential problems with this picture is that so within the poetic naturalism scheme, then there's kind of a sense in which we get to decide what's real. The idea of this kind of standard idea of like metaphysical realism is that there is a mind-independent reality, and it exists completely independent of our perceptions of it, our ideas about it, the way that we talk about it, or the social construct that comes out of it. And what's particularly strange about this in the framework of naturalism is that. So one of the first law of naturalism was that nature is all that exists. And do you really want to talk about these emergent phenomena, specifically, you know, the rules of basketball and things like that, as if that's real and as if that's nature? Just raising some questions there. But I'll move on because I do want to make it to the end. So on to what Carroll says about knowledge. So according to Carroll, the big questions in the big picture are going to be answered just by science and logic alone. And by logic, he includes mathematics in that. So logic, he says, tells us all the possible ways the world could be, and science tells us the way that the world actually is. And he's going to choose abductive inference over deductive and inductive inference. So that means he's going to say we should be coming up with a bunch of models, and we should be testing those against observed phenomena rather than deducing things from first principles or just generalizing from observations. And science, according to Carroll, is not methodological naturalism. So one thing that I should have said right from the beginning, so there's methodological naturalism, which we've talked about a lot. If you've been at this conference, it's something that we talk about a lot. So Carroll's definitely talking about metaphysical naturalism, meaning he thinks that nothing besides nature exists. So according to Carroll, science is not characterized by methodological naturalism, but by methodological empiricism. So the idea that knowledge is derived from our experience of the world rather than by thought alone. He says science is a technique which consists of imagining as many different ways as the world could be, and then observing the world as carefully as possible. Science tries to find the best explanations for what we observe, and if the best explanation is a non-natural one, a supernatural one, that's the one that science would lead us to. So this is Carroll's claim, and essentially what this allows him to do is, taking a very broad perspective on science, is to treat God as if God is that scientific hypothesis. And so a lot of other atheists will say that, say, God is outmoded, or that revelation is no longer trustworthy, and that's why God doesn't exist. He's going to say, no, God is a valid scientific hypothesis, and it's disfavored by the data. So it's a bit different packaging. In the final analysis, you kind of end up debating the same things, but it makes for some provocative quotes. Okay. So according to him, our knowledge is founded upon science. We use the abductive method to figure these things out. And he also says that we can assign these credences to our different models and update them appropriately for every factual proposition that may or may not be true about the world. So does God exist? Can conscious experiences be explained in purely physical terms? Are there objective standards of right and wrong? So he's actually going to evaluate, are there objective standards of right and wrong based on the way the world looks? According to Carroll, the best way to evaluate whether or not anything exists is to imagine how the world would look if it did or did not exist, and then use abduction to determine which of the models best matches our world. And so it's important to point out this is not the same thing as simple inference to the best explanation, because it's limited to objective evidence. So that means observable, reproducible things, data is what he's after. So here's an example of something that is completely inadmissible under Carroll's framework. It's a quote from C.S. Lewis. So there's one thing and only one thing in the whole world which we know more than we could learn from external observation, and that one thing is man. We do not merely observe man, we are men. In this case, we have, so to speak, inside information. We are in the know. So I'm sure many of you have heard that quote before. So if that resonates with you, that is not something that could potentially play a role in Carroll's way of thinking about things. So some potential problems with that. Carroll says right from the outset that personal experience is not very convincing to those that haven't had that experience. And that's fair. But there's also intersubjective experience. There's those subjective experiences that you have, things like moral impulses and a longing for meaning, that like they're not actually completely limited to you. You can go and talk with other people, and there are patterns that stretch to, across all of humanity. That to me is it's different than just personal in completely subjective evidence. I don't think it's treated quite carefully. And then this sometimes leaves him neglecting the central point of things to focus on incidentals. So, a good example, objective standards of right and wrong. Nobody believes that because of the way that the world looks. So it just leaves kind of confusing to discuss it as if this is the right methodology for examining, say, abstract objects. Okay, so his chapter titled "Abducting God" is a very clever chapter, or at least the title is very clever. So this is where he says, science has provisionally concluded that naturalism is the best picture of the world we have available. And he makes this claim in other places by saying, God is not a good model. So this is, if you listen to his talks and stuff, he uses that phrase a lot. God is not a good model. And as I already talked about, he's much more direct than other atheists by, you know, taking God on as a scientific model. So he's going to use Bayesian abduction here. So here's some math. I'm strapped for time, so I'm not going to go through the whole thing. But the point is that you can just take a model, and you can observe some data D, and you can figure out how likely the probability that your model is correct given some data, and it'll be proportional to something like just the probability that your model is true prior to taking any data. It's called a prior. And then there's likelihoods here. And the likelihoods are just saying, are accounting for data. They're saying, what is the likelihood of obtaining this data, D, if M was true? So under the assumption that that the model M is true. And the downside to Bayesian abduction is that there's this prior, and it's subjective in many cases, not always, but for our purposes it will be. The upside is that if M is really robust and has strong predictions, then and you can find relevant data, then your likelihood's going to end up dominating the final calculation anyway, and the kind of unreliability of the prior. Will end up, it won't carry the majority of the weight anyway in your final analysis. But what this really requires in order for this to be useful is predictive models and relevant observable evidence. So I'm running short on time. I'm going to try and do this really quick. So his argument goes something like this. Let's consider two models, theism. A personal God exists and he created the universe. Atheism. No, there's no God. It's a godless universe. He sets the priors at 1/2, just relatively, atheism's relatively simple, and theism has more explanatory power, so that kind of makes sense. And then he turns to making predictions on the two models, and then things get kind of complicated. So he's saying here, what we're supposed to do is imagine, as fairly as possible, what the world would probably look like according to each of our two possibilities, and then compare it to what the world actually is like. That's really hard. It is really hard. Neither theism nor atheism by itself is an extremely predictive or specific framework. Now, if you remember on the previous slide that I had said, you kind of need to have predictive and specific frameworks in order for this to be useful, this is a problem. Okay. So I don't have time to explain this. Sorry. I'll jump right straight to the evidence. So Carol is going to say, I'm going to give you a bunch of features that I would expect the world to have if God made it. And then point to the lack of those features as evidence against theism. So his pieces of evidence are so these are all things that you would expect, he thinks, if God made the universe. There'd be no evil or suffering, tons of miracles, religions would reach the same conclusions independently, the cosmos would only contain what's necessary for human life. Religious texts would reveal true, intuitive, non-testable information, like the germ theory of disease or something. Human origins would be distinct from the rest of biological history. There would be ghosts, and there would be karma. Okay. So, sorry, I do have to wrap up. So, and he also says how strong that evidence is another question entirely. And that's a fair point. So, Carroll's suggested pieces of evidence against God are nothing new, and I don't have to say that many things about them, but the veracity of his proposed evidence seems to be entirely dependent on how you think about God. So he's trying to embrace this like objective framework, but yet, you know, the predictions of the models are still entirely subjective, so it kind of undermines the idea of doing this in a predictive way. So theism is a category that encompasses many different conceptions of God, and it's far too vague to be a useful model. So Carroll is essentially presenting eight features he would have included in Nature if he was God. This is not helpful. So we would, we expect that God is not like us. We don't, we worship God because he is not like us. If our ideal conception of creation doesn't match the world we see, it could easily mean that those elements of perfections were lost or that we don't understand God properly. So most of Carroll's eight features are not all that likely under biblical theism. So let's talk about, so if theism involves a God who wants human beings freely to choose a relationship with him because he himself is worthy of our affection and not because of the nice goodies that he'll give us in exchange for obedience, then, eight and one are not that particularly strong. Furthermore, if mankind rejected God, if they exchanged the truth about God for a lie and worshipped and served the creature rather than the creator, as Paul says in Romans 1:25, then 3 is significantly ameliorated, although I do think 3 is probably his best one up there. If God scorned superstition and wanted people to live based on their knowledge of the regular patterns by which the world operates, rather than interpreting every happenstance as some form of divine judgment and petitioning God for concerns that are actually well within their own control, then 2 and 7 there would expect to be false. I don't know why anybody would have 7, but... and if God's sole intention for revealing himself in Scripture was to reconcile that relationship that had been severed, then 5 would probably not be true. Lastly, if God took great pride in the beauty and vastness of every corner of his creation and desired his human regions, the pinnacle of the created order, to be intimately connected with the cosmos and not distinct from it, then 4 and 6 are as inconsistent with atheism as they are with theism. A few of these properties are a little more likely under biblical theism than atheism, 3, for example, but not by much. And there is this other evidence that he does admit for God, which I don't have time to go through. So with that, I will conclude. Thank you for listening.
I'm just going to say, since there are only 2 talks in this slot, Ed, would you be available for that empty slot?
Great
for
idea.
All
I would love to do that. That's yeah, that would be great.
So
yeah.
So that way
I could even do my last 3 slides.
Totally. Randy is always right. Okay. So after the next talk, Adam has agreed to stay. I'm sure lots of people have comments and questions, so if you're interested, stick around and have an informal seminar. Is that good?
All right, that sounds great.
Great. I would just make a brief comment that I'm always thrilled when a physicist acknowledges that biology is real. And I don't know if you'll need your slides, but you're still set up. So anyone who wants to remain, that's fine, and we'll start questions.
I think I'll just kind of pick up where I left off, and it was a perfect place to leave off because Don kind of, I was going to spend a half a slide on the evidence for God, and then Don just came up and gave a much more careful, detailed, thorough explanation of that. So that was really, really, this was designed, not by me. So the point that I wanted to drive home, but I kind of had to skip over some slides about Carroll's framework, is that in Bayesian abduction, when you're talking about 2 models that are mutually exclusive, so one, God exists, the other, God does not exist, any piece of evidence that that'll be relevant to either model is going to always favor one and disfavor the other. So even if you have, say, two models and one for a particular piece of evidence, it would be 99% likelihood in one model and only 90% in the other. That piece of evidence, if you obtain it, will favor one model, and not having that evidence will favor the other one, even though the particular piece of evidence is actually very likely under both models. And so this is what Carroll leverages in making these arguments here, because that means you're allowed to just kind of come up with ideas that of things that would be evidence for one model, and then if you see those things, it favors that model. If you don't observe them, then it's evidence against that model. So that's why, you know, he's giving what I call missing evidence. He's saying, if there was no evil, that would favor God. There is, therefore, it disfavors God. Okay, so one thing...
Mm-hmm. Wasn't it Richard Swinburne that it came up with a 97% probability using this that God existed?
Yeah, for the resurrection. I was just informed about... Seth just informed me about this. Yes. So it's an interesting framework for thinking about things. So one quick thing just to say about missing evidence is that, so I have an example here of how missing evidence functions. So say you're going to do a Bayesian abduction of whether or not your new neighbor is a golfer or not a golfer. You're moving into a new place and you want to know, is your neighbor a golfer or not, okay? The data that you can collect is to just kind of peek over the fence and see, is there golf balls lying in the backyard? If you set your priors at 50% as to whether or not your neighbor's a golfer, and I just made this estimate up. This sounds reasonable to me. If you estimate that 1 in 1,000 golfers have golf balls in their backyard, and like only 1 in 1,000,000 non-golfers do, you know, their kids play with golf balls or something, or they live near a golf course or something like that, the actual positive evidence is like significantly better than this missing evidence. So if you do the calculations using Bayes' theorem here, if you were to peek over the fence and observe golf balls, your probability goes way up. It goes up to like 99.9% from 50 that your neighbor is a golfer. If you observe no golf balls, it doesn't change very much at all. You go down to, you know, the probability that they're a golfer, if there are no golf balls in the backyard, goes down to 49.975%. And my only point in making this is that this missing evidence, it does count, but it's not nearly as strong as, like, positive evidence is.
So absence of evidence is not evidence of absence.
Yeah, it's weak evidence of absence. Yeah. Within the Bayesian framework, so just something to keep in mind. Okay, and so in all of these pieces of evidence for God that Carroll mentions, you know, each one he mentions it, and then it's always followed by an explanation why he doesn't think it's very good evidence. But that's okay. The important point here is just that it would be more likely under one hypothesis than it would be under the other hypothesis. So that's the thing. So I'm not a big fan of the fine-tuning argument from the constants of the universe, but I can admit that a finely-tuned cosmos is more likely under a cosmos created by God than it is under an atheistic universe. So that's the relevant thing within the Bayesian framework. Okay, so some potential problems. Okay, here's the quote. We assign prior credences and update them appropriately to every factual proposition that may or may not be true about the world. Does God exist? Can our inner conscious experiences be explained in purely physical terms? Are there objective standards of right and wrong? This is a little over the top, I think. Okay, this needs to be brought back down to earth. Well, it is true that we have credences for our beliefs. That alone doesn't mean that Bayes' theorem is any help. So the theorem requires predictive models and relevant observable evidence. Without that, the likelihoods cannot be assigned. If you assign a subjective prior and you lack objective likelihoods, you've incorporated the method's weakness and you've neglected its strength. You're not giving yourself, making this helpful for yourself. So it's pointless to use abduction with models, or at least Bayesian abduction in the way that that he uses it, using only objective evidence, if your models make vague and ill-defined predictions or forecast things that can't be observed. And the important point here is that atheism is just as unpredictive of a model as theism is. So that's something to keep in mind. Not all beliefs translate into predictive models about what the way the world would exist, such as are there objective standards of right and wrong. That doesn't mean that they're wrong. It just means that abduction is not the right tool to use in examining every single belief. So Carroll's aware of these limitations, but since he's kind of dismissed all of the alternative modes of inference, he has to use Bayesian abduction even when it seems like it's a fruitless enterprise. Okay, next thing. Carroll says, what matters more, so after he goes through this whole argument, the kind of last statement in this chapter is, what matters more is understanding the basis for making progress on this and similar questions. This is what I really wanted to talk about today. I think that's just not true. We can kind of think about this question as to whether it's possible to investigate God's existence scientifically. And by scientifically, I mean based on objective evidence. We're not going to use intersubjective evidence. Does the data, does the model account for the data or not? Type of thing. Is this the right way to think about this question? I think this is anything but an adequate basis for answering metaphysical or religious or existential questions. The particular issues he runs into, namely the models aren't predictive and the evidence is ambiguous and subject to different interpretations, aren't merely issues to be tidied up in another book. They demonstrate just how impotent the scientific methods are when talking about things beyond the realm of nature. Every academic discipline, if it's linguistics, literature, history, has their own methods for investigating things, ideas, and evaluating different claims. And they all depend on the domain within which you're exploring. So if you're going to investigate the existence of a personal God, why would you use methods, like scientific methods, that are designed to strip away the personal element from the truth-seeking process? So just one example in which scientific methods strip out the personal element. I mean, in my field, we do blind analyses. And what blind analyses mean is that you don't look at your data, piecemeal. You come out everything, you get everything all ready to go, and then you kind of, you multiply things by random numbers to make sure that you don't know the final answer when you do your checks, and then everybody in the team agrees at once, we're going to unblind everything, and then in theory, if you're perfectly blind, then whatever you unblind, even if it's completely wrong or totally contradictory to what everybody else says, you have to publish it that way. And part of the reason we do this is to remove observer's bias. This is just one example in which things that are using your prior knowledge is very, very helpful for coming to the truth. And when you're trying to come to the truth in normal modes of operating in your life. But in science, we have to get rid of that. This is very different. So just a bit about, I think that science investigates and explains nature on its own terms, and I think that's why science is successful. If you look at nature, I think the primary difference between nature and the supernatural is that nature is immediately available to us. It's available to our manipulation. We can grab it. It's available to us. We can manipulate it, and we can perform experiments. It's tangible. It's immediately available to us. That makes experimentation possible, and it's also repeatable experiments because it's available to everybody else. In addition, it's unsurprising. We can predict the way that nature behaves. And none of these things are true of a supernatural realm or of God. They're significantly less true of personal entities, even like human beings, which are, we're notoriously hard to predict. And so you can do, you can use scientific techniques, and you can do things like psychology and sociology, but it's very different. It's a very different kind of science. The social sciences and the natural sciences are different, and this is definitely a natural science type of approach to this question. So God has, we already talked about divine hiddenness, so that's helpful. God is hidden. He's inscrutable. He is unchangeable. He's not subject to our manipulation. We can't run an experiment on God under different conditions, nor can we really do that with human beings that easily. God is perfectly free, and most importantly, God is personal, and that means that he's allowed to, to make his own, he's allowed to do things differently, and he doesn't have to follow these set patterns like natural laws that guide nature. And because of that, the nature of these two realms, the natural and supernatural realm, are very different, and it doesn't really make sense to try and adopt the pattern or the procedures that are used in science to address this question. So God has to be sought on his terms, and God being personal should be sought on relational terms, and rather than appealing to objective evidence, it's not that that's completely irrelevant, it certainly is relevant, but God wrote this book, and it should be consulted when trying to come up with a model for what God is like. And that's going to be a lot more helpful, I think, than taking data. So, if you consider an experiment in action, okay, observations are made and characterized, data is collected, ideas are consolidated into models, models are tested, and if all goes right, it leads to a theory of some aspect of nature. And you get vast amounts of data that are condensed down into a theory. You throw out outliers that don't make sense. The complicated external world gets presented into a simple, digestible format. And best of all, it makes testable predictions if it's a good model. And so this is science, and it's completely, it's a very powerful tool for understanding nature, but it's completely ambivalent to anything spiritual or transcendent. So it doesn't really say much one way or the other. The reason experiments are helpful for one and not the other is just the nature of the two different realms. Okay, so in conclusion, I agree with Carol that God is not a good model. I disagree that this framework is a helpful way for thinking about things. God's existence can receive support from scientific findings. I think that that's true without making God into a scientific hypothesis. It's just that you can come up, you can discover certain truths about nature from science, and you can use those truths as part of an inference to the best hypothesis, but it's unhelpful when you do the opposite thing and try and take God and then convert him into a scientific hypothesis and try and look at objective data. So abduction based on objective data is inconclusive because it's just the wrong tool for the job. Atheism is as unpredictable as theism is. I didn't really talk that much about the evidence for, but atheism doesn't even predict that there will be a universe, that there will be a world. That's if there's one piece of evidence that does come from theism is that you will have something, you will have people. you will have people who long for meaning and for moral moral goodness, and you will have so there are many predictions that come out of theism. It's just that they don't translate into objective data in this straightforward way. So I think Christian theism makes few predictions about objective data, but it makes many nice and very clean, crisp predictions about a person's life, and that's probably the more important evidence to consider. So science investigates nature on its own terms, and I think that's why it works. And if we're going to investigate God's existence, we have to do it on His terms, not on scientific terms. Thanks.
Yeah. Well, a couple of things. I mean, as you just pointed out, the fact is the one thing that atheism doesn't really help with is why there is any world.
Right.
And in fact, when I was preparing for my talk a couple of days ago, I was watching a video of Sean Carroll's.
Yeah.
And he basically made the same kind of statement that I referred to as Bertrand Russell's. You know, the universe simply is. It's a bare fact. We just have to accept that.
Yeah.
And so he's not trying to go the way of saying that science by itself can explain why there is a universe. But you posted the slide. One of his conclusions is science has provisionally concluded that naturalism is the best picture of the world we have available. Well, yeah, science gives the best description of the physical universe.
Because
yeah,
it's
but it
talking about
explain
nature.
Explain why there's a physical universe to explain. And, you know, you can say it's just a bare fact, but you haven't provided a better explanation than the existence of God does.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I actually have, my backup slide here. So. One of the things that you had said here, so Carroll, in his rejection of these other modes of inference, says, so he says, we can't short-circuit the difficult task of figuring out what kind of universe we live in by relying on a priori principles. So he rejects statements like, you know, nothing comes from nothing. He says, this is we have no evidence for this. And it's once you forego, you know, conclusions like these that are, for many of us, I mean, the idea of something coming from nothing, you don't need scientific, you know, testing grounds in order to see that this is just, it's just an obvious thing. And it's very helpful in coming to deductive conclusions about the universe. So he also, you know, rejects the idea that whatever begins to exist must have a cause, or that for any true statement there's a reason why it's true. That opens up brute facts, that the universe is just a brute fact. There's no reason why it's there. So yes, thank you for that.
Yeah. Well, to follow up on that, how tentative is Carroll on his conclusions and concerning epistemology, how limited are humans in understanding?
So he's very enthusiastic about science and thinks that, you know, and including beyond the realm of nature. And so he thinks that this is the right way to think about things. And so he doesn't necessarily say that he's made a conclusive case, but he's definitely convinced that this is the proper framework to think about this, and thinks that science is, you know, has shown these things. So it's hard to say. Like, I don't know if that quite answers your question, but he's very optimistic that by using Bayesian abduction, you can come to the truth about, like, everything. At least he seems to be. Yeah.
Well, as Pushville say, thank you for your presentation and for the example of taking on somebody like Sean Carroll as a big dog on his own terms instead of sidestepping the issue. Someone whose training is in chemistry and not philosophy, I can understand why people would be would go along with his argument, because we see science from the inside that the general public doesn't. And maybe picking up on what Jerry's plenary speech talked about was everyone has faith in something. In naturalism, the language seems to be upcoded to axioms instead of faith.
Mm-hmm.
How, do you have any suggestions for how we can communicate our beliefs across the divide?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think there's a few things that are helpful just to bring people back down to earth. If you have a lot of these discussions, like as I do with my colleagues and stuff, there are many kind of common dogmas that appear again and again that if you confront somebody about directly, they really don't have any answer for. So one that I get from physicists all the time is they for some reason think that if you can calculate something, if you can calculate a number, then it's science. But they all know that I can make actually fairly good physical arguments and come up with equations and calculate things that are wrong, like really wrong, like way off by a lot. And I can do that, you know, across many different domains. And so it's helpful to like say that to somebody, and then we have a calculation of the anthropic principle saying that, you know, our universe is very unlikely and stuff. It kind of diffuses it. And you know, one thing I'll say if I'm short on time or something is like, well, does science tell you that your mother loves you? No, okay, well, do you believe that your mother loves you and that you're justified in that belief? Yes. It's like, well, then you must know it upon some other grounds. Tiny little things like that that I've just kind of developed from talking to a lot of people can go a long way, but it takes a lot of repeated, I think, interactions to make a difference with people. Yeah?
So I have a speculative question. So as a physicist who has also done human subject research, I completely agree that we have clumsy quantitative tools for understanding human behavior, but I also see that as a field that is constantly progressing towards more refined measurements. Do you think that they'll reach a particular threshold when the measurements by psychologists and sociologists will be considered quantitative enough by physical scientists that they'll need to be taken with more consideration? And if that does happen, how do you think that's going to change this type of dialogue?
So that's a good question. I'm very skeptical that physical scientists are ever going to be on board or lend a lot of credence to social sciences. That's because of snobbery, really. So the two, like when I had shown the two realms, I mean, I think human beings we're both. We're natural and yet we're not. And because of that, it's very difficult to predict what people are going to do. And so the better that we get over time, I think that the social sciences will, you know, they'll receive some more credibility, not from physical scientists, though, unfortunately. But I think that, so, and then you also asked, like, how...
So let's suppose that they did meet this threshold.
Mm-hmm.
And I know we're in speculation land right now, but how do you think that would change the dialogue?
If you had robust models that came up with like with concrete predictions, that would change. That would change things. I think so. I don't think it would change necessarily the things that I've been talking about, but like this discussion among scientists would change.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, one thing that strikes me in this is that if you go back 50 or 80 years, and you look at some of the discussion on the philosophy of science, you know, kind of back in that time frame, you'll hear about the loss of positivists, you'll hear about Popper and his response, and I'm not hearing, you know, even Carroll talk in a way that sounds like science is defined by Popper. That's a hypothesis that can be tested actually falsify, not verify.
Yeah.
And so I'm intrigued by this because it's as if, you know, he's lost his mooring on what science really is. Because we tend to think of it a lot now in society as we're understanding what reality is, where in fact what we're doing with science, I believe, is really finding a range where it's not falsified. That's
yeah.
a very different piece.
Yeah, it's that's like very good point. I think that the philosophy of science is the biggest weak point in this
yes.
book, actually, and it's becoming. I think it's going to get worse over time, just from my interactions with other graduate students and scientists. Really, don't want to talk about philosophy of science.
But it's
and
you know,
yeah,
it's significant. And I don't
it's
know
very significant. Yeah.
I even believe that in the climate argument, there are such weaknesses in the philosophy of science used to advocate for climate
mm-hmm.
change that it really isn't science.
Right.
I know it may be heretical for people, and it makes it a challenge, I think. They keep saying they're hanging on science, and there's a lack of that falsifiable model
yeah.
testing. I think it's a weakness just across the board. So I just want to throw that out. I think it's a way to throw a wrench in our plans as well.
Yeah, and that's a very good point. I think as science has, you know, we've come to the point where science is so deeply ingrained in the way that we think about truth that it's people are unable to kind of step outside of that framework and ask, okay, why is this even the case?
What are our articulated assumptions?
Yeah, yeah, and it's a very important thing to do. It's as important as you know for science as it is for discussions about science and religion. I agree.
Thanks for staying on.
Yeah, no, thank you for allowing me to.
All right.